you, Richard, and I guess your last comment provides a nice challenge for our colleague from Amnesty International to respond to. So I'll give the floor to Samir now.
Thanks so much. So yes, I'm Samir Dasani. I'm representing Amnesty International's Demand Dignity campaign, which is on poverty and human rights. Many of you know me from my prior employment at a place called 50 Years Is Enough, where we were really a grassroots organization challenging the policies and practices of the Bretton Woods institutions. So let me, instead of reflecting on the report, as I listened to Roberto talk and as I listened to Richard talk, I was thinking, well, actually, this report needs a sequel. And I know I know you guys always work a year in advance, so I'm sure you already have the title of next year's report. But you know, maybe something about this crisis, financial crisis, or any kind of crises, are opportunities, and what those opportunities are. And I think Richard has alluded to some opportunities that he thinks are going begging. Of course, a crisis is not just an opportunity; it's a disaster. And I think the report does a great job of documenting, in people's own words, the kind of disaster that they're going through. And I don't mean to belittle any of that by my remarks. Why did that disaster happen? The economic growth that was promised, this unending bounty of Western Europe and Japan and North America, that the rest of the world was basically supposed to provide services to and thereby grow, that stopped. It's worth saying, I don't want to gloat about it, but it's worth saying that many of us have been warning that it was bound to stop, since at least 1980, if not before. Some of you have been in this business a little bit longer than I have, but since the advent of the structural adjustment policies of the late 1970s, early 1980s, many of us have been saying, look, is it really wise to advise, countries in Western Africa, countries in Central America, countries in Eastern Asia, countries in South Asia, to all export coffee? Is that really a wise policy? And export that, and not even to process the coffee, but to export raw coffee and have it processed in Europe and so on. Is that really wise? And of course, it's not wise. The other tenets of the Washington Consensus, the privatization, budget austerity, it's kind of always been a recipe for disaster, hasn't it? We didn't need our advanced degrees in Marxist economics or what have you to be able to tell you that this is a recipe for serious, serious disaster. And just to take a little bit of issue with something that Richard said about alternatives, I do think that by and large these systems are fairly well understood. We've been writing papers about this for years and years and years, and I think some of the best work, at least some of the best work that I've seen, is by the Korean economist Ha Jun Chang, who documented in a series of books how every country in the world has developed and sort of the recipes and the policies. And yes, it isn't uniform. But it's a fairly similar story, by and large. And it's a story that was denied, and it continues to be denied, to most countries in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And there's one incident that Ha Jun Chang narrates that I'll just share with you, which is that in the 1970s, when Japan first attempted to produce automobiles, it failed miserably. I believe it was Toyota was the first company. Someone will correct me. But whatever company it was, Toyota or Honda, they exported a few cars, failed miserably. Straight away, the Ministry of Finance turned to the people who were promoting this, who I believe were in the Ministry of Trade, and said, aha, we told you, we need to be exercising our comparative advantage. We need to go back and be a nation of fisher people and so on and so forth. Well, naturally, Japan didn't listen, and look at Japan now. I don't think these ideas are rocket science. If a country with as few natural resources as Japan can follow a development path that was even at that point fairly well tread, and come out of it looking like Japan looks today, for all of its faults, I think countries that are far more resource rich, and I have in mind countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo in Africa, or the entirety of Latin America, really, especially South America. If countries that are that resource rich cannot, at least get close to Japan, then something is seriously wrong. The G20 has been alluded to, and I'll just allude to it one more time to say that in the G20 right now, you get the feeling that the IMF and other institutions that promoted this method of this market fundamentalism, to use the term that Richard did, they're being rewarded for their own failure. There's no acknowledgement that these are the institutions that promoted these policies that were a complete disaster. And instead, they're being given more resources. They're being given more power. And yes, okay, they're meeting with my colleagues in Washington D.C. and others, and saying, "Oh, we've changed our ways." But you can look at the loans. You can look at the policies. They all contain elements of exactly the same stuff. Exactly the same, banking liberalization policies in Eastern Europe, trade liberalization policies in the Pakistan structural adjustment loan, or PRG, whatever it is. They no longer call them structural adjustment loans. The only one that I saw, at least that I've looked at, that didn't contain some of these were the loans to Iceland, which then raised all sorts of north-south questions. I mean, are we only going to give loans without conditions to countries in the global north and not countries in the global south? Is that how we're going to operate? Is that the level of I don't know what we want to call it, institutionalized racism that we've been drawn to? At a certain point, I think we have to acknowledge that these policies and the institutions that promote them are a kind of insanity. I mean, it's doing the same thing again and again, exactly like the case in Thailand, where you had problems with regulation, so you deregulate. Though that's exactly what's being proposed even in the developed countries. Even here in the United States, the latest round of the rumors that are coming out, this is not legislation that's passed, but the rumor is that the result of the processes that were put in place after the collapse of Lehman will be to actually institute further deregulation. I mean, it's complete madness. You're doing the same thing again and again and expecting different results. Okay, on to the opportunity. I think this is an opportunity to take back the reins towards an economy where we're actually putting the needs of people, we're putting the human rights of people above short-term profit and above the profit of a few, frankly. In order for that to happen, there needs to be a shift of power away from the Bretton Woods institutions, away from the G1, if you like, away from the United States really dictating the rules of global economics, and towards something else. Now, Roberto says that something else is the United Nations. I don't know what the something else is. If it's the United Nations, great. I mean, I think there's the possibility for some real democracy out of all this. Let me just say that the few initiatives that we've seen from the UN, including the MDGs and so on, don't necessarily inspire that much confidence. The MDGs were fairly low targets, and even those low targets there hasn't been a really sustained commitment to seeing that done. And there's no room for human rights at the table, really. I mean, we're not talking about ending the systems that impoverish people. We're talking about, okay, lowering the number of actual individuals who happen to be impoverished by X percent or what have you. I think we need to take a more systemic analysis and be willing to say countries all over the world have a right to follow an economic path that will not impoverish masses of their own populations. And I don't think it's rocket science what those policies might be. We in the developed world have an opportunity to stop bailing out the rich. At least I hope we have an opportunity to stop bailing out the rich and to start prioritizing our own needs. But unfortunately, I think we may be losing that struggle. And for myself, as an American, one example of us losing that struggle is that, okay, there was no debate and no big ruckus per se. I mean, there's a little bit of infighting in the Congress and so on. But there wasn't a moral outrage around the country when $1.2 trillion was spent bailing out the financial sector. That was over about a year. In fact, less than a year. But the thought of spending $1 trillion over 10 years to reconfigure the healthcare system so as to not even provide coverage for everyone, but I think the latest figure is about 92% of people would be covered by Obama's plan and so on. I mean, we can't even realize the human right to health in this country. And we're not willing to spend the kind of resources that we spend to bail out the financial sector in order to realize the human right to health. I think that's a real problem. And it's a real problem here in the United States, and it's a real problem globally, and that's one of the beautiful things about this report, is that I think you are beginning to see an analysis developing, and I hope we can all continue to develop this analysis, that is dividing the world, yes, on the basis of global north and global south. I think those distinctions are still relevant, but even more importantly, on the basis of a global class analysis. There's a massive global underclass And some of them, you know, are a few feet away from us on the streets right here in New York City, and others of them maybe in the favelas of Sao Paulo or in the slums of Kibera in Nairobi or what have you. So, and then there's a, you know, there's a middle class that, you know, maybe smaller than the massive underclass, but still significant. And then there's a tiny, tiny group of people at the top who control a massive amount of resources. Who control, you know, in this country, I believe the top 2% of the population control something like 28% or 30% of GDP. In countries in the global south, it's far, far worse than that. And I think we have to be talking about inequality. We have to be talking about, you know, how can we, as a civilization, as a human community, how are we willing to tolerate that kind of inequality when people are not even realizing their right to basic services, their right to food, their right to clean water, their right to adequate housing, and so on. So I'll stop there.